Hey everyone, welcome back to Captain Hunter's podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for your support. Please make sure that you hit the subscribe button. If you're listening on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever, that you are hitting that subscribe button. That way you can be notified whenever I release a new episode of Captain Hunter's podcast. Today we got a good episode. Today we're going to be introducing you to an organization called LEAP, Law Enforcement Action Partnership. So what you can do is you can go to lawenforcementactionpartnership.com and check out LEAP. It is an organization that is dedicated to police reform, to criminal justice reform overall, police community relations, incarceration, harm reduction, drug policy, and a number of other issues. We have a number of speakers that are affiliated with the organization. I myself, upon leaving law enforcement, have joined LEAP and have become one of their speakers. I'm looking forward to being a part of that particular organization, to doing my part to help bring about some serious criminal justice reform. Today's episode, we're going to be speaking with Judge Shanta Owens. Now, she is a member of LEAP. She is currently still a judge in the state of Alabama, and just going to be talking to her and seeing about her interactions with LEAP and how she came about and being involved in LEAP and all of her community actions. So let me just tell you a little bit about Judge Shanta Owens. Judge Shanta Owens is a product of both the Bessemer and Birmingham public school systems. She is a graduate of Ramsey High School. After completing high school, she went on to attend Alabama State University, where she excelled in her coursework and was recognized as a consecutive member on the dean's list. Judge Owens graduated summa cum laude with a Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Information Systems and set her sights on law school. After completing her undergraduate studies, Judge Owens attended Louisiana State University School of Law and the Universitat de Haute-Marsol in Aix-en-Provence, France. I know I completely butchered how you say that in French, but she went to school in France. Just know that. Where she enrolled in the dual degree program and received both her Juris Doctorate and Bachelor of Civil Law degrees. During her time at Louisiana State University School of Law, she was actively involved in Phi Delta Phi Legal Fraternity and Unification of Diversity Under the Law, an organization whose mission was to unite diverse cultures through legal awareness and activities. Let me just read to you a little bit about her professional and community involvement. 2014-2015, participant of Momentum Leadership Class, Children's Village Board and Directors. She's been on the National Association of Drug Court Professionals, Alabama Association of Drug Court Professionals, Alabama District Judges Association, Alabama State Bar Association, Birmingham Bar Association, Entertainment Section, Women's Lawyers Section, and Criminal Justice Section member, past member of Public Service and Alternate Dispute Resolution Committees, Judicial Council of the Magic City Bar Association, Birmingham Inn of Court, Alabama State University Alumni Association, Louisiana State University Alumni Association, the Women's Network, Cumberland School of Law, Moot Court Volunteer, Jones Valley Development Corporation, Incorporated, former board member, co-wrote a grant that led to thousands of dollars for the creation of community-based health initiatives in disadvantaged areas, Redmont School in the Waldorf Tradition, former board member, Birmingham Public Library Board, former board member, parliamentarian and chairperson of the Long Range Planning and Committee. You can read more about all of her professional and community involvement on her website, judgeowens.com. I read from you the why section. Now, with all she's done, she's married, got a couple of kids, so I don't know when she has time to actually find time to sleep. Let's get into the interview. Enough of me rambling on. Here is Judge Shanta Owens, judge in Jefferson County in Alabama. Thank you so much to her for coming on the podcast. And here's the interview. Hope you guys enjoy. Thank you, Judge Shanta Owens, for being on the Captain Hunter's podcast. Thank you so much for your time. I know that you're busy. I read you through your bio. I know that you're an extremely busy lady. Now, you and I first met through the LEAP program, Law Enforcement Action Partnership. So you remember that as well as I. So just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved with that.
Okay. I reside in Birmingham, Alabama, so I am from the South, and I attended Alabama State University for undergrad. Then I went on to Louisiana State University for law school. I completed my law degree and a bachelor's of civil law because I also studied at the University of Aix-Marseille in Aix-en-Provence, France, where I enrolled in a dual degree program. And after I completed law school, I moved back home to Birmingham, Alabama, and began working as a prosecutor with the Jefferson County District Attorney's Office. And Jefferson County is the largest county in the state of Alabama. And so I worked there for about 5.5 years, and I started out as a baby prosecutor. And when I left 5.5 years later, I was the senior trial prosecutor in my assigned courtroom. Left there, and I ran for the seat for a district judgeship at that time. I was a district judge for 10 years, and in January of 2019, I was appointed by the governor to fulfill a circuit judgeship, and that's what I am currently doing. I currently preside over felony level trials in the circuit court in the criminal division of Jefferson County. And I just recently became involved with Law Enforcement Action Partnership. I think I was invited on a panel, to speak on a panel here in Birmingham concerning the organization, and just kind of fell in love with the work and just all of the policies that are instituted through the organization. And that's how I became involved. So I haven't been involved with LEAP very long, but I've been involved for a little while now.
Okay, good. Now, you actually went to France for your degree, is that right?
I did. Well, I studied a semester in France. So I was there for about 3 to 4 months because part of my law school, I attended law school in Louisiana, and Louisiana is a civil law jurisdiction. It is a little different from the other 49 states when it comes to the code of law. So I went for a full semester there, and because I enrolled in a dual degree program, so I received my Juris Doctor when I graduated, and also a Bachelor of Civil Law, because I did a lot. I actually studied a lot of civil law. Now, that didn't help me much because I moved back home to Birmingham, to Alabama, which is not a civil law jurisdiction. And so I ended up taking the Alabama bar, and I've been here practicing since that time. But it was a wonderful experience.
I can imagine it was. Now, I'm not familiar with what do you mean by the civil law state? What does that mean?
Okay. Most states follow the common law, but Louisiana is a civil law jurisdiction. And it really is just really more in procedure and how things are done in the courtroom. There is not much difference except procedurally. Things are done a little different in civil law versus common law. But European countries are civil law jurisdictions. And so that's why I studied in France, because France is a civil law jurisdiction and Louisiana follows a civil law code.
Okay. I should have went to law school. Maybe I'd be able to follow that a little bit. So as I was reviewing your background here, I went to the website judgeowens.com, and mm-hmm. I read through a lot of that, and there's a lot to read. You have done a lot. I don't even know how you found time to sleep and have a couple of kids. so good for you. So you are very heavily involved in the drug courts and drug rehabilitation programs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I sure can. When I initially took the bench in 2009, I was the presiding judge of the Jefferson County Drug Court program here in Birmingham. And Jefferson County Drug Court is the largest drug court program in the state of Alabama, quite naturally, because Jefferson County is the largest county. And so during that time, my docket consisted mainly of drug cases. Now, I had a regular criminal docket, but I would say about 90% of my docket consisted of drug cases. And a great deal of that time consisted of presiding over the drug court program. And our drug court program here in Jefferson County, and of course, I must admit I am biased, but I believe it is one of the best drug court programs just in the nation. And I've had the opportunity to travel to several different jurisdictions and take a look at their drug court programs. But what we do in Birmingham is, if you are charged with a drug offense, you will appear in court, and assuming your case is eligible, and most drug cases are eligible unless it is a trafficking charge or unless you're selling, there's evidence of sales, that is not eligible, because drug court truly seeks to rehabilitate a drug addicted offender. And the amazing thing, what I love about our program, is that once you complete support program here in Jefferson County, then your felony conviction is dismissed. It is set aside. It is dismissed with prejudice, and you can thereby get it expunged from your record at a later time. But even aside from that, our program is a real rehabilitation program. It is run by case managers. We have a staff of maybe about 7 or 8 case managers. So each defendant will have a case manager that they report to. We have a treatment coordinator on staff. We have a medical team who's here to assist with medically assisted treatment for those offenders who may have a hard time coming off of drugs, and especially opiates, cold turkey. We're able to assist in that. I mean, it is a really robust program. We help with housing. We help with transportation. We help with treatment needs. It is a full service program that seeks to change the offender's lives and not just get a quick result. You know, I used to tell the defendants all the time in drug court that this is not a diet. This is not a quick diet. This is a lifestyle change. Like, I'm not here to try to help you lose 5 pounds in a day. I'm here to truly change the way you look at your life and the decisions that you're going to make. And everything we do in the program is designed to do that. And let me say, this is another thing that we do in our program that a lot of programs don't do, is we have an assessment of each offender who comes into the program. And the assessment takes a little bit of time. It takes about 90 minutes. But based upon that assessment, we know where to place a defendant. And we have 4 tracks, track 1 through 4, track 1 being the shortest track, and track 4 are typically our high need offenders, who are typically IV heroin drug users who have attempted treatment before and they're just having a hard time, because we try to keep different levels of people separated from each other and try to treat high risk, high need offenders together by not mixing them with our low risk, low need offenders.
I got you. Wow. Okay. Does that particular program keep statistical data? Do you know how successful the program is?
Okay, I have not been the drug court judge since January when I got appointed to this new seat. So I don't know what the data is, but we most definitely keep statistical data. And our numbers, the last numbers I checked before I left, we had an 88% success rate when I left. Now, I don't know what those numbers are, and I would assume that those numbers are still just as good, if not better, because the judge who was appointed to replace me still has a heart and a passion for seeing people succeed in the drug court program. But I was very proud of our 88% success rate. And that was large part due to understanding addiction. You know, I'm a former prosecutor, and I can tell you, I did not go to law school to become a social worker. But drug court was a bunch of social work and understanding addiction. So I had to do a lot of outside work to understand that addiction is not an exact science, and you can't put a number on how many times a person tests positive or how many times they relapse or they go back to a bad behavior. As long as they continue to work the program, then you have to have the resources available to help them. And that's what I was committed to the 10 years that I ran the program.
So judges are picked for this particular assignment because of a passion that you had, or is that how it's done?
No. The way our judgeships work here is that you run for a particular seat. And I'll tell you, this is how I ended up running for that seat. I've never been into politics, I can say, and I was fairly young when I left the DA's office to run for the seat. But I ran for the seat because at the time, the judge who had started the drug program, he retired. He retired from the bench, and so the governor at that time appointed someone to the seat. And I was just really, really, really concerned. I was, you know, I had been in the DA's office at that time for about 5 years or 5.5 years. And I was concerned about the person who was appointed, because I said, these are people's lives. I've never seen this person in this courthouse. How can you preside over a program that directly affects people's lives? And every courtroom in the criminal justice system affects people's lives. You know, we're talking about life and liberty. And I was so upset by that I literally just talked to my husband about it and said, hey, I think I can do this. I don't have any political capital. I don't have any political experience. I'm not connected to anyone, but I believe that I can do this because I do not like people sitting on the bench making decisions about people's life and liberty, and they haven't been in this courthouse before. So I ran for the seat out of a passion for the criminal justice system, but not necessarily out of a passion for drug court itself, but that passion grew once I took that seat and I put myself in a position to learn as much as I could about drug courts just throughout the nation. And I built our program, and I had a good program to start with because I didn't have to start it from the ground up. The previous judge had started the program, but I was able to really enhance our program with different things throughout the year. And so throughout the years that I was there. So.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. That's good. That's really interesting. I did not know that that's the process. Do you know if that's the mm-hmm. process? Is that the process that other states in the union take as far as their drug courts, as far as people running for seats? And
well, I will tell you. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, please.
I was going to say, in Alabama, we typically choose a seat. So you kind of know what you're getting into when you run for a seat. You know what docket that seat will handle. Now, the presiding judge of each circuit can always transfer us to different divisions. He or she has the power to transfer us within the circuit to different divisions. So you can always move. But now most other states don't do it like that. Most other states, they have what they call like a rotation. Like you may be in civil court handling civil cases for a while, then you may be moved to the criminal docket. But most states do not have where you run for the drug court seat and you will be in that seat until your retirement, unless you're moved. Because in all honesty, you should probably only preside over a pretrial diversion program for about 5 years at a time. There should always be fresh eyes on the seat, and so that the judge is not burned out also.
Yes, I'm pretty sure that's the way Connecticut does. That's where I'm at, is in Connecticut, and I'm pretty mm-hmm. sure that there's okay. a rotational type of tenure or whatever. So I'm
yes.
mm-hmm. most familiar with that. Yes. So I also see that you're heavily involved in the community. What I was most impressed with, according to this website, judgeowens.com, is that you had middle and high school classes come to your courtroom and watch the court proceedings. And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I quite often will host middle schoolers and high schoolers in the courtroom, and I will have them to come in. I try to always schedule them on a day that I will have something in court because I know they like to see what's going on in court. So I will always schedule them when I'm having court or when I'm in the process of a trial. I let them see about maybe an hour of what we do in trial or an hour of what we do in court. And then I step off of the bench and I talk to them and I allow them to ask me questions. And they will typically ask me questions about how long did it take you to go to school? You know, what made you interested in it? How much do judges make? What do I need to do if I'm interested in law school? The conversations are always just wonderful for me, and which is why I always do it, because I enjoy that. But I do that probably 3 to 4 times a year in my courtroom. And then we will always have a conversation about safe interaction with the police, responsible use of social media. And then I will always end with talking about the consequences of their actions, like even when they're young, but talking about how their criminal history stays with them their entire lives, and good decision making and the consequences of actions, even when you're young and you aren't really thinking about it. So it typically is, when I do it, I typically spend about maybe between 2.5 to 3 hours with the students. But.
Wow, that's a considerable amount of time.
Yeah. I really enjoy it because I enjoy talking to the younger kids, because sometimes, you know, I'm not so sure people really understand that their criminal history will follow them their entire lives. And I tell them, Alabama, we just got a provision for expungement a few years ago, but up until then, even if a case is dismissed against you, we did not have any provision for your record to be expunged, even upon a dismissal. And so a few years ago, the legislature passed laws whereby under certain circumstances, but those circumstances are still very narrow, So I try to get them to understand about friendships. And if you and your friends are riding in the car, and if there are four people in the car and there's marijuana found, you know, in the center console, who gets charged? And that starts a really good conversation, typically with young people. When I tell them everyone gets charged in the car, the police, they don't have to figure out, you know, who actually bought the marijuana, who placed it there. Everyone is in possession of it. So we typically have a long talk about constructive possession versus direct possession, so that they will understand that you can be in constructive possession of something just by being in the area or having it, you know, just in your presence.
I can remember having a conversation like that with my son, you know, them not understanding, yes. not understanding that. And he was like, what, uh-huh. what? So yeah, it's, man,
exactly.
This is
like, I'm amazed that every time I have this conversation, the kids are always like, what, you need to tell me I can get charged? And I always tell them, that's why it's important to choose the company you keep very wisely. And then I always tell them that I've never had anybody come into my courtroom and say, hey, judge, let him go. Those were my drugs. I said, when everybody gets charged, you're left to fight alone for yourself. And once this is on your criminal history, that's it. It is on forever. Your criminal history follows you forever.
Yeah, that is something that's definitely needed. And I'd like to do more speaking to young kids myself to help them to understand these particular sentiments and tactics that the police use and different laws and things like that. So I think it's really important. I think that's really mm-hmm. good that you do that. I can remember being a young kid and going to court. We didn't ask those type of questions, but I certainly think it's really, really important. You and I are both relatively new to the LEAP organization, and LEAP is geared towards getting the public and the police to see eye to eye, to work together, criminal justice reform and things like that. Tell me what your thoughts are about criminal justice reform across the board, police interactions. I'm researching another topic right now about asset forfeiture. Tell me what your thoughts are about all this kind of stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay, let me start here about bail. You know, let me tell you my thoughts on bail, because this has been a huge ordeal in Alabama within the past few years, trying to get the public and judges to understand that bail is to secure presence in court, and it's not to punish an offender for the crime charge. However, judges must be very careful. We must, with bail, we must seek to secure the defendant's presence in court. We must seek to protect the community from violent offenders. But more often than not, bail is used as punishment for the crime charged. And I have a problem with that. Like, you know, personally for me, I have a huge problem with that. And in having a problem with that, I am not a judge who will go around and give a signature bond to a capital murder defendant or to a defendant who charged with horrific rape first degree case. But I will say this, I lean towards defendants being on bond until they are convicted. Now, there are way too many defendants across this country who are incarcerated on nonviolent offenses and they cannot make bond. I have a problem with that. I have a problem with incarceration of people on nonviolent offenses and they are unable to make bonds. And sometimes the judge will reduce a bond to an amount and say, well, hey, I reduced it. But if the defendant still cannot make the bond, that is tantamount to a no bond. And even in some of our seemingly violent cases, the Commonwealth, or whatever jurisdiction, whatever prosecuting authority you live in, if they are asking that a defendant be held on a no bond, or if they're asking that a defendant be held on a very significant bond, then they should be able to demonstrate to the judge that the defendant has a prior criminal history and is violent to the community, that defendant has previously failed to appear in court before and therefore should be held on a higher bond, or that the crime is particularly heinous in comparison to other crimes, and so therefore the community needs to be protected. And More often than not, that's not the case. And let me give you an example. Just recently, a young man here in Jefferson County, but it did not happen in the Birmingham division. It happened in the Bessemer division of our county. Our county is split up into two divisions. But a young man stayed in jail, I believe, for 2.5 years, at least two, but I believe it was 2.5 years. He was charged with, I believe, like a burglary charge, a rape charge. DNA evidence showed last week, after he spent 2.5 years in the county jail, DNA evidence showed that there was no way it could have been him. He had maintained his innocence all along. His mom could not afford to bail him out of jail, and so he stayed in jail 2 years. And those situations happen way too often. This young man in 2 years could have been in school, he could have been in college, he could have been manager at a job by now, but he lost 2 years of his life for a crime that he did not commit. And I'm not saying that, and I don't even know who the judge was, I'm not saying that judge should have released him on a signature bond, but I am saying that the judge should have required the state, the prosecuting authority, to give him some reason as to why this defendant could not have remained on bond pending the investigation and trial of this matter. And, you know, and that's one example, but these examples happen across this nation every day. And that is an example of a violent case, but there are many more examples where defendants are charged with nonviolent offenses and they are being held in jail. Another thing. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want me to stop there?
No. I was going to. There was a case in, I think, New York City, and I was just looking that up. New York City, where a kid was held almost the same amount of time, 2 years or so, for stealing a purse or something like that, and then he couldn't make bond, and he came home, he committed suicide. I don't know if you heard about that.
You know, and those types of things, like, they have got to stop happening. But it also means that our judges have to be, you know, socially conscious about other people and their positions. And so diversity on the bench is a really good thing. It is an important thing, and it is a good thing. And I'm talking about diversity across all ethnic groups and across genders, because as a woman, I bring to the bench something that my male colleagues, you know, they don't bring. And of course, they bring things that I can't bring as a woman. But I am a mother, I'm a wife, and I'm a former prosecutor. So I bring all of those life experiences to the bench. And that's important. Like, my perspective is important, and it needs to be valued. And so therefore, we have to make sure that, and for me, because I'm on the bench, I'm passionate about this, we have to make sure that we have Black judges, white judges, Latino judges, Asian judges. We must have women, men. We've got to have people who are homosexual, heterosexual. We've got to be able to have people on the bench who do not look like us, who do not have the same life experiences as us. We have to run on party lines in Alabama. Our judgeships are, you have to run as a Democrat or Republican or whatever party you want to, but Democrats or Republicans are the party here. We need Democrats and Republicans on the bench, and we need them on the bench in every facet of this court system. And that doesn't always happen, because when we have a diversified bench, that's when we'll see true criminal justice reform. But as long as everybody is preaching the same message and the choir is singing the same song, we're not going to get anywhere. And so it is very important that we are constantly seeking to understand people outside of our positions. And people who are less fortunate than us typically have their days in the criminal justice system. And we've got to be able to understand their circumstances. We've got to be able to understand the indigent population. We've got to be able to understand people that grow up without a mother and a father in the home. And if they had a mother and a father, that they come from less spectacular situations than what we come from, but we've got to be able to punish people appropriately and understand how to use the power that we have within while we're on the bench. And so, you know, this is a conversation I could go on for days about things that I'd like to see done. Those are just two of the things that I'm passionate about.
How receptive are other people that you work with? I'm talking about prosecutors and or judges to your, that frame of mind that you have that we need more diversification.
I will say, luckily, here in Jefferson County, I have the opportunity to work in a with colleagues who are extremely receptive to that, extremely. Prosecutor's offices, our public defender's offices, I get an opportunity to work in what I believe is a progressive jurisdiction. Like, we're really interested in criminal justice reform here. And it's from our judges to our prosecutors to our DAs. Now, with that being said, we are only one of 67 counties in Alabama. And I'm not saying the other 66 aren't progressive. And there are a few more who probably are progressive, but the great number of counties in Alabama are not as progressive minded as we are here in Jefferson County when it comes to trying to really do things for criminal justice reform here. And so it makes it a little hard for the entire state. But Jefferson County, where I work, we have a diversified bench here that I'm proud to say.
Now, that is Jefferson County, I would assume, it sounds more liberal and more diversified in and of itself. Is that a reason why?
Yes, it is. Yeah. You're absolutely right about that. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I assume now. Listen, I'm from Connecticut, and all I hear is about the good old boys and the good old boys in the South. So you have to. So I don't want to. I had actually planned to move to the South, but that is a concern of mine as to what part I move to because.
Okay, and that is a great concern. I mean, because I'm not here to tell you that the good old boys aren't here, but I am here to say that, you know, Jefferson County and some of our other surrounding counties and other places in Jefferson County, I mean, not in Jefferson County, but in Alabama, are wonderful places to live. Alabama is a beautiful place, but I wouldn't lie and tell you that we don't have, you know, a ways to go, you know, when it comes to forward thinking and you know, and trying to think about encompassing a world that encompasses people that don't look and think like us. We do have a ways to go in that, the state as a whole, but there are wonderful places here, and Jefferson County tends to be a gem here. Like, it's a gem in the state of Alabama. I'm partial to it, but, you know, but I'm here, I work with it, and I know the great group of people that I work with here.
And you were born and raised there in Alabama, right?
I was. I'm actually originally from Selma, Alabama. I was actually, my mom and dad are both from Selma. My father is deceased, but my mom is still living. And we moved to Birmingham when I was in second grade. I lived in Montgomery, Alabama, which is the capital of Alabama. I lived in Montgomery for a year when I was in first grade. And then in second grade, we moved to Birmingham. And outside of college and law school, I've been in Birmingham since.
And your work with police officers, how is that? I saw that you work with their Birmingham Police Academy at one time. How do you, how has that experience been?
Okay, what I would do during that time is I would teach new recruits about the Alabama Criminal Code and about testifying, just about courtroom demeanor. And I did a lot more of that when I was a prosecutor in the DA's office. But I have a great relationship with law enforcement here. We have several municipalities, Birmingham Police Department being our largest police department here. But I have a great relationship with even the smaller municipalities. And I'm proud to say that for the most part, of course, you know, you always have a few bad apples, but for the most part, I'm really proud of our, you know, the municipalities here, and especially Birmingham Police Department, really proud of the sense of community that they have here and how they're truly trying to be community officers. Like, I'm proud of that. And most people wouldn't think that because they hear Alabama and they think police and they just think really bad relationship. But that's not, I don't find that to be the case here.
Well, that's great to hear. I mean, this podcast is dedicated towards building the relationship between the community and the police. And I'm glad to hear that certain things that we've heard here in the North, at least I've heard, are not necessarily the truth. So that's good to hear.
And I wouldn't seek to overstate it and say that there aren't some bad experiences, but overwhelmingly, more often than not, I believe the relationship here with the police and the community is one of the better types of relationships across the nation.
I'm very glad to hear that. Very glad. Mm-hmm. California recently passed a law, AB 392. Are you familiar with this? They passed a law changing their standard of use of force, particularly use of deadly force, from reasonable to now it is what's necessary. Have you followed that case at all?
No, I am not familiar with that.
Okay. So basically what they've done is they've gone away from the use of reasonableness, right? What a reasonable officer believes at a certain time and whatever he's dealing with. So now the standard is that the officer has to be fairly certain and necessary. So whatever use of force, it has to be necessary. Now, it has not been defined by the legislature as what necessary is. So what's going to have to happen, unfortunately, is that someone's going to be killed by the police, and then they're going to apply this law and see if the judges or whatever believes that whatever actions the officer took was actually necessary. So it's going to be something that's going to be coming out.
I didn't, that's always, a pretty hot topic. And, I have lots of thoughts about that. One of my thoughts is when an officer leaves home, and this is how I always explain it to people. When an officer leaves home, he hopes to return home to his family every day. And we're asking officers and first responders out here, we are asking them to put a lot on the line to protect us. And when we're in danger, we pick up the phone and we call the police because we're expecting help. In that same vein, we expect that the people that they encounter, that they will not meet those people with fear, a gun, and a badge. That's not a good mix whenever you have fear coupled with a gun and a badge. But we also, and this is what I also tell young people, but the police should also be able to encounter you with respect. That's going to be very interesting for me because I'm saddened every time I hear about someone dying. I'm saddened every time I hear it. And circumstances and situations are different. And I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. But I think we should be able to tell our police officers that we will respect you and we will abide by command. But we should also be able to tell our sons and daughters and family members that if they meet the police, that they will not be met with fear, particularly because of the color of their skin, and that they too can make it home.
Yes, I totally agree with that. I think that it's a two-way street. Cooperation is a two-way street. The police need to cooperate with us, and we need to cooperate with them. There should be no reason for us not to show our hands or to run away and things like that. That's my advice. First of all, is make sure that you're living a life that you don't have to run away from the police, first of
and second
of all, police officers need to be able to de-escalate a situation. I mean, things are going awry, and listen, I don't think it's too much to ask for that our officers are sure about what they're doing. Shooting first and saying he might have had a cell phone, I might have been a wallet, is completely unacceptable.
Unacceptable every day of the week.
Yes. Listen, this was a great, great interview. I certainly thank you for speaking with me. Is there anything that you'd like to say as far as wrapping up? How can the community, the police work together as far in your role as judgeship? How can we all work together to form a more perfect union, if you will?
Okay. I always say, in order for us to come together, in order for us to have a great relationship with community and law enforcement, have to spend more time together. It's like any relationship, any friendship, any marriage. You got to spend time together. And you have to spend time together when you're not arguing. You got to spend that time together. And so neighborhood days where the officers who patrol the beat, they need to be there. And the public, the community, they need to welcome those officers there. This sounds a little bit of Alabama-ish, but I, you know, and I get that, but you know, what about having like the officers over, the officers who patrol your beat, you know, to the table for dinner, you know, once a month or something, just kind of have them stop in, you know, those types of things will build build relationships in the community. And especially for people of color, we have always been taught to have a distrust of the police, and we got to start changing the conversation, you know. And we have to start telling our children, like when my children were young, I always told them the police, those are your community helpers. That's what they are. That when you see the police, they're a community helper. And we've got to start changing the narrative of what we teach our children. We've got to start spending time together and building a coalition so that when the police see even a crime being committed, something that's wrong, they can say, hey, come here, so-and-so, come here. You know that's wrong. Come on. I got to take you down, but come on. Let's do this without anything bad happening on our part. And I seek to do that in my courtroom. I send people to prison every week up here because I am a felony court judge. So people go to prison, but I do it with respect. I do it with kindness. I let them hug their family members before I take them into custody. And I let them know that their voice will be heard. But I also do my job. And if you got to go to prison, you got to go to prison. And so we've got to start spending time together, quality time together. And I believe once we spend quality time together and we start telling young people and we start reshaping their view of law enforcement, we can change. We can definitely change the relationship between the community and law enforcement.
I don't think that is very Alabama-ish at all. I think that's actually very wise. When I was on vacation one time, I ran into a preacher, a reverend, and he was from Philadelphia. I start, we have a conversation. I tell him what I do. He tells me he's a preacher. And he said he misses the time. He's African-American as well. He misses the time when the police officer was a cop on the beat where they were in their vehicles and they were actually walking around and getting to know the public. And I think that is very wise. And so my chief, well, he's a chief in another place now. He's a former chief of the Waterbury Police Department. He actually mandated that our officers use our downtime to go walk through parks and just go see about how the people are doing, you know, walk down the street.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was, that community oriented policing is very important. It's certainly not something that is isolated in Alabama. Like I said, the guy from Philadelphia wanted, our police chief wanted to do it. And I think that many people are really understanding that community oriented policing means getting out of your cars and doing what you have to do and meeting with people. The department,
absolutely.
The department which I just left, they have actually instituted these community type days. They shut down a whole street and have like a kind of a city kind of block party. They just had it last month in July. So where people, they give out hot dogs and people could come and look at our command vehicles, sit in the police cars and all that kind of stuff. So they can see exactly what we're doing. And they had they had a bouncy house and all that kind of stuff. So it's extremely important, extremely important.
Important. And when we do more of that, then things will change. Definitely. Yeah. The relationship will change.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to ask you one last question. You talked about bringing prisoners. You have to send prisoners to jail every week. Does that take or send them to prison every week? Does that take an emotional toll on you to do that?
Wow. It's amazing you asked that today. I'm actually, before this call, I was actually in a murder trial. I've been trying a murder case this week of a young man who had never been in trouble before, came from a good family, never been in trouble before. The jury returned the verdict at 10 a.m. this morning. And when they returned a verdict, they didn't find him guilty of murder, but they found him guilty of manslaughter, which is a lesser included offense of murder. And that, looking at him, hugging his family, because I took him into custody. He was out on bond pending the trial. I took him into custody. He hugged his family. The two families, the defendant's family and the victim's family, they were crying and hugging each other and telling them that, you know, they were going to pray for him also. You know, although he got convicted, they were all crying. I got emotional. And wow. I'm a pretty tough cookie, but wow. I got emotional. And I got emotional because I said, now my job is going to begin because I'm going to have to sentence him in October. In October, I have to sentence him. And I said, wow, now the pressure is on me about what do I do with this young man's life who has taken another life. And there are families in here who were civil to each other. Like they have lost a child, and one family lost a child through death, and another family, they've lost their son to Dave beginning because he'll have to serve some time in prison. And that took a toll on me because I'm a mother. And for a moment, I became emotional. I don't want to say that the job takes an emotional toll on me, but I will say this. I think I am appropriately emotional because I don't want to lose my sense of having an emotion about this. Because if I do, then that means that I will easily send someone to prison without thinking about the loss of their liberty. And I don't want to do that. I want every time I sentence a man or a woman to prison, I want to feel some kind of way about it, because I never want it to be where it's me taking someone's liberty away from them. It's just, they'll be okay. They can go to prison. No, I want it to always be a thoughtful and deliberate thing that I do. And I sentenced the young man on Monday, another murder case I tried some months ago. His sentencing was Monday, and I sentenced him to life without parole, without the possibility of parole. Wow. And that wasn't easy. It wasn't easy for me to do, but I did it because the fact of that case and the law dictated that that's what he needed, was life without parole. But it wasn't easy for me to do. So yes, it does take an emotional toll on me, but I welcome that. And I don't ever want that to leave, because as long as I'm handing out sentences in prison, I need to be emotional about it so that I will always understand that I am taking away somebody's freedom.
Wow. That is awesome. And that's good to hear that there are judges out there who have some type of sympathy and empathy for their defendants. Wow. Judge Owens, I certainly appreciate your time. If the people of Alabama are not grateful to you, I certainly am grateful to you. You do a lot.
Thank you.
You do a lot for the community. I would certainly suggest that people go check out judgeowens.com and look up your bio. It's really very fascinating, and the things that you've done and the things that you're continuing to do, particularly for the drug courts and everything like that you've done, and your empathy that you bring to the bench. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for so much for being on Captain Hunter's podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it and look forward to any future conversations.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. I definitely be calling you again.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay.
Bye. I hope you guys enjoyed that interview with Judge Shanta Owens. She truly is an inspiration. I want to say thank you once again to her being on the podcast and for all of her work in the community. Please go to judgeowens.com, read up on her bio. It's very long. She's done a lot for the community, numerous organizations. So thank you once again to Judge Shanta Owens. Please subscribe to the podcast. If you like what I'm doing, if you're listening on iTunes or Google Play or whatever, that you're hitting that subscribe button. That way you can be notified whenever I post a new episode. Thank you once again for listening. Thank you for your time. Make sure you hit me up at CPTL Hunter, Captain L Hunter on Twitter, CPTL Hunter, CPTL Hunter on Instagram. Hit me up in the email, hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com, hunterpoliceconsulting@gmail.com. Please make sure you subscribe to my blog, subscribe to the podcast. And that's it, ladies and gentlemen. Until next time, take care, much love and peace. Bye.